Hi, I'm Nathan Weinbender, film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time cheerleader for black and white films.
And I'm Dan Webster, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that loves cinema history as much as the newest art house offerings. And today we're tackling a big one, 1941's Citizen Kane, celebrating its 85th year and a brief return to theaters. There's so much to talk about with this movie, so let's get right into it. When Kane started filming in the summer of 1940, its director, producer, co-writer, and star, Orson Welles, was only 24. He was already known for co-founding the Mercury Theater Company and for his infamous 1938 War of the Worlds radio broadcast. The studio, RKO Pictures, had given him total creative control of his first feature-length motion picture. The script, which Welles wrote with Herman J. Mankiewicz, begins with the death of publishing mogul Charles Foster Kane, played by Welles himself, and his final mysterious word, Rosebud, sparks an investigation into his checkered, turbulent, and ultimately empty life. Citizen Kane was highly anticipated, not least because newspaper magnate William Randolph Hearst, the obvious inspiration for Kane, tried to bury it. And when people saw it, what they got was a movie that didn't look, move, or sound like other mainstream American entertainments of the time. It was praised by contemporary critics and won an Oscar for its screenplay, but it divided audiences and underperformed at the box office. And most movies Welles made afterward were either compromised by studios or abandoned. Then, in the 50s, Kane was re-released and its fortunes turned. For the next 40 years, it ranked number one on the British film magazine Sight and Sound's poll of the greatest films of all time, and it has twice topped AFI's list of the 100 greatest American films. So, with all that out of the way, let's start with this question. Do either of you remember the first time you saw Citizen Kane?
I believe I have this memory, but, you know, who knows? Maybe I conjured it up in the deep recesses of my brain. But my mom was a big film goer and film fanatic. And I think that that came, and we've talked about this before, out of her Depression era, you know, go to the movies for all Saturday, get rid of your kids for the day so you could work. And in my case, my grandparents operated a restaurant. And so she always took us to the movies from an early age. And so in the late 1950s, early 1960s, I remember going to the Palace Theater in Peoria, Illinois, and seeing this film, because my mom, sometimes she'd cover our eyes during the gory parts or the inappropriate sex parts, but she thought that nothing was off limits for her kids.
Well, I grew up in a family that used to go to the movies in the drive-in theaters, which they existed a lot in the 50s. And so I never saw Citizen Kane until early in the 1970s. I had gotten out of the Army late 1969, and I spent the next year or two just watching every movie I possibly could. And one of the ones was at San Diego State University. And I went there with a bunch of friends, and let's just say that we got a little joyous in the parking lot before we went in, walked into the total dark, and all of a sudden, News of the World comes on. I was transfixed, and I just sat there with my eyes open and my mouth open even wider the whole time. It affected me so much that I said, someday I have to become a movie critic.
So when you say you got Joyce in the parking lot, you were having some Yoo-Hoos or something like that.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. They were little donut holes.
Little, you know, slushies.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I think I first saw Citizen Kane as a teenager, wanting to educate myself about the history of movies. And when you start studying the history of movies, this is one that comes up as, you know, a required text,
yes.
Right?
And as are the films of Ingmar Bergman, yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly. but you know, it's always mentioned in the same breath as, you know, Casablanca and The Wizard of Oz.
Yes.
And I probably saw it on videotape. And I knew I was supposed to like it, but I probably didn't understand it. And it was seeing it again on DVD with Roger Ebert's audio commentary underneath it. That's when the movie really clicked. And he explains all of the historical context behind the production, the technical and narrative innovations. And I think most importantly, he describes just the painstaking technique that went into pretty much every shot, all of the optical effects, the matte paintings, the lighting and the set design. And that stuff really blew my mind.
Which is the point, because when people ask, why do I need to watch this stupid movie that's all these 8 decades old? It's in black and white. It's about people I don't even care about. It's because it changed filmmaking.
Yeah.
There are very few movies in which you can say there was filmmaking before the movie and then filmmaking after. This is one.
But even talking about it in that way, and we're going to talk about the technique of Citizen Kane a lot because there is so much in it. I think even talking about it that way can make it seem intimidating. And I wanted to talk about Citizen Kane, not just because it's celebrating an anniversary and because who doesn't want to talk about Citizen Kane, but because I encounter people all the time who consider themselves big movie fans, even consider themselves fans of older movies, who have never taken the plunge and watch Citizen Kane. And I think it is because it has that reputation of being, you know, this monumental achievement. And maybe in people's minds, that seems like it's going to be challenging or homework.
Yeah.
And even looking beyond the technique, which you shouldn't, this is just an exceptionally entertaining movie. It's a great story about this, you know, American success that mm-hmm. also is representative of all the foibles of American success.
Yeah.
And I think even if you just watch it on a purely narrative, emotional, character-driven mm-hmm. level, it's so rich and right. fascinating in that way, too.
Well, I think most of us can understand the notion of, well, I think I should watch this. It's exactly how I felt about Yi Yi. 3.5-hour movie, Chinese movie.
Yeah.
Why do I want to watch that? We finally watched it. An amazing film.
Revelation.
I would suspect that there are more people in our age cohort who've seen this, you know, at an earlier point.
I think you're
because,
right.
you know, like I said, it did get some hype again in, as you pointed out, in the late 50s and early 60s or whatever. But I have always been fascinated, and I've mentioned this on the show previously, about people who direct and do all this other stuff related to the film and then also star in it. I don't mm-hmm. even understand that. I don't understand that. And especially because this was so technically intense and proficient. I mean, his star turn as, you know, Kane
is
particularly notable to my way of thinking.
And he plays him over the course of his entire life.
Yes. Exactly. And so I think, you know, I know that the focal point is on the production, the technical aspects, but the acting, Joseph Cotten, I mean, you know, all of these people who were
Dorothy Cominghor is great.
Were in the film, I thought, did an amazing job.
And supposedly the theory behind Kane's innovations is that you have this, you know, hot-headed upstart, this 24-year-old guy, never made a movie before, but kind of like Charles Foster Kane buying the newspaper, he maybe thought it would be fun to make a movie. And mm-hmm. supposedly the reason that Kane is the way it is because Orson Welles didn't really understand how movies were made, so he didn't follow any of the rules. And when he would have an idea for a shot that any other production would have been, that's not a possible shot. His cinematographer, Greg Toland, who I think we'll talk about, basically made it possible, mm-hmm. even if that meant digging a hole in the floor of the studio mm-hmm. so that the camera could be really low looking up, because Welles had this vision in
his
head.
So many of those shots are from down below.
Yeah,
yes.
With the ceilings, you know, right above their heads.
And just think, I mean, he was a primary promoter of independent film. I mean, I think he inspired, I mean, we talked about Nouvelle Vague this past year and Jean-Luc Godard. I mean, I think he pioneered this whole notion of, hey, even if you're young, if you have an idea and you're creative and you're allowed, you can do your own thing and it can be successful. And so, I mean, that's the essence of independent cinema. And he continued to do that. Even if his films did not make money, he continued that for the rest of his
and
career.
And let's point out that RKO Pictures was a studio, but they gave him total control. He could do whatever he wanted. Later on, let's face it, it got taken away from him. But
I know. I recently read a book titled The Director about filmmaking in Germany during World War II. And it is fascinating the time that this film was, you know, produced. You know, was a time of turbulence. And so the fact that RKO let him do his own thing is pretty amazing.
Thank mm-hmm. God they did. Before we go, I want to say that I found this quote from the critic David Bordwell, and he said, "The best way to understand Citizen Kane is to stop worshiping it as a triumph of technique." And his argument was that those techniques weren't exactly new when Welles used them, and that by just focusing on them, you're almost shortchanging the emotion and entertainment in the story. But with apologies to Bordwell, I think we're going to continue worshiping the technique of Citizen Kane in the second half of the show, and we'll also talk about some of Welles's other films. Okay, well, that was the first part of our discussion of Citizen Kane, which turns 85 this year. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Dan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to continue the discussion. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
You've already discovered that Spokane Public Radio is an excellent source of news and entertainment. But did you know that this station is a nonprofit? Public radio is for the public, available to all, free of charge. That's possible thanks to people, just like you, who give what they can to support open access to information. So thank you for listening and for making all of this possible.
And we're back. This is Movies 101. I'm your host, Nathan Weinbender, and during the first half of the show, Dan Webster, Mary Pat Truthart, and I were discussing the many merits of Citizen Kane. Let's jump back into it. I want to start by talking about Greg Toland. We mentioned him in the first half of the show, but he was the director of photography on Citizen Kane. By the time he shot this movie, he had made dozens of films with directors like William Wyler, Howard Hawks, John Ford. And even though he was only 36 when they shot this movie, he was one of the old guards on the set. Right.
And he died way too young.
Yeah, he was only 44, and it was 7 years after Citizen Kane. And by all accounts, Toland sort of taught Orson Welles how to make a movie in real time. And Welles shared his directed by card at the end of the movie with Toland because he felt that Toland's contributions to the film were that important. And Toland used a technique known as deep focus cinematography. And what that means is that the entire frame is in focus, and it gives the images just a shocking clarity and
depth.
And Welles, as a director, he loved to cram every frame full of detail. And here you can see all of it. And there's a shot near the end of the movie that really struck me this time, where it's after his second wife Susan's disastrous opera performance. And Jedediah, who is Kane's longtime friend and the drama critic of the paper, he's started writing a scathing review, but he's passed out drunk. And Kane gets to the office and he decides, I'm going to finish the review for Jedediah. And there's this shot where you have Kane at the typewriter in the extreme foreground. Then Jedediah, after he wakes up from his stupor, is walking toward him from yards away. So he's in the middle of the frame. And then you have Everett Sloan as Kane's business manager, Bernstein, in shadow in the far background.
All in focus.
All in focus. And it strikes you immediately because it's just a dramatic composition. But then Welles holds the shot and he lets you sit with it. And then you realize the entire purpose behind that composition is to show how the dynamics between these guys who have gone through hell together, those dynamics are now shifting.
Right. Right.
And it's just, it is one of the most amazing images in a movie full of amazing images.
And I think it's a perfect example of the notion of collaborative filmmaking, because you've got Toland, who's the cinematographer, who basically in most cases the cinematographer is the guy who decides the lighting of the scene. Then you've got the director who's got this vision, and then you've got the camera operators, all who have an opinion about we can do this, we can do that. And in terms of Citizen Kane, it's just perfection.
And we talked about the fact that many people will never have the opportunity to see this on the big screen, even though it has relatively recently gotten a couple of showings here. And I must say, I mean, I would not watch this on your phone or on your computer, Nathan.
I did not watch this on my computer.
If it shows up on a plane. But I think that if you have a decent sized TV, you're going to get a lot of the benefits of what you're talking about in terms of the sharpness. And that's why I love black and white film. Mm-hmm. I mean, for some reason, it's able to capture a mood in a way that color films, you know, can't. And we've talked multiple times about how color films look all washed out. It's like everybody has cataracts all of a sudden and they can't see anything.
Well, nowadays.
When you go to the theater. Nowadays. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Yeah. So this is worth seeing for a variety of reasons.
And something we haven't really talked about is the William Randolph Hearst of it all.
Mm-hmm.
Because everyone at the time knew that Charles Foster Kane was a thinly veiled avatar for Hearst, who, you know, was a huge, powerful publishing magnate at the time.
And the Rupert Murdoch of his time.
Basically. And no one's really sure if he ever saw Citizen Kane, but he got word about what was in the movie.
And he tried to stop it.
And he tried to stop it. Supposedly, he offered RKO a huge sum to destroy prints of the movie before it could come out. And supposedly, it was not so much because of the unflattering portrait of himself, but because of the unflattering portrait of his mistress, Marion Davies,
mm-hmm.
who is basically portrayed as, she's Susan Alexander Kane,
yes.
in this movie. And she's kind of seen as this sort of shrill, untalented coattail writer.
Yeah.
Wells later on said that he regretted making her into such an obvious caricature. I mean, it is kind of a mean portrayal of someone who was alive and well known at the time. But I think that that whole history behind it is
fascinating. I think Hearst should have been most upset about the fact that they made Xanadu, the sort of hideaway, the palace, so creepy when San Simeon, the Hearst castle, is amazing. I mean, I did not go there for years and years because I thought it was going to be super schlocky. It is truly amazing. And so I think that's why Hearst should have been ticked off. I'm just saying.
It's on my bucket list.
Okay.
Well, we've talked a lot about Citizen Kane, and again, millions of words have been written about this movie, but why don't we talk about some of Orson Welles' other movies? Because this guy was no one-hit wonder. And he never made a movie that reached the same peaks as Kane, but there are so many good movies that he directed over the years, some of which were sort of hard to see for decades and decades, but most of them have been restored now. Do you have any favorites that aren't Citizen Kane?
Yeah, I've got to go with Touch of Evil.
Yeah.
It is based on a pulp novel, and it's changed an awful lot in the movie. It was changed a lot, an awful lot from the initial concepts to what was finally put on the screen. But it starts with a single take scene that's 3 minutes and 19 seconds long, and it is incredible.
Yeah.
It's incredible. It starts with a close up of a clock on a bomb being set, and then it ends up moving around the streets, and you see Charlton Heston and Janet Leigh walking along. It's an amazing scene, and the film itself it features some really good performances by other Mercury Theater players, Ray Collins for one, but Welles himself plays
amazing.
He was still relatively young, and he plays this overweight, old, grizzled, veteran detective.
One of the sweatiest characters in movie history.
About Marlena Dietrich.
Marlena Dietrich, Akeem Tamiroff. I mean,
Weaver performance.
That was great. He was so twitchy.
So weird.
Just like Chester. Yes, yeah. Exactly. So I have to say, I love Touch of Evil.
Well, I'm going to shout out The Trial.
Yeah.
So this is a take on Kafka's book that was written in the 20s. And so now he's, and it does change things a little bit at the end, but it's, you know, it's very Kafka-esque in its presentation, and Anthony Perkins plays, the
Joseph K.
Mm-hmm. The mysterious Joseph K. And throughout, we kept looking at these different female performances, and Dan would say, "Oh, that's
Romy Schneider,
Jean Moreau,
right?
Yeah,
exactly."
Yeah, yeah.
And but it's a longer film. But it does capture, I think, exactly what you would think about in terms of, the term Kafkaesque has turned into something. And for me, I think being associated with the law, it does resonate in a different way. Also, this is the film where she was not in the film, but he met his mistress and long-term collaborator, Oja Kodar. Is that you pronounce her name? And so I think it takes place in Croatia. It's filmed there, and it's like eerie Eastern Europe. I think it was very masterful.
Yeah, and if nothing else, the production values of this movie are incredible.
They have scenes with like hundreds and hundreds,
hundreds
of people.
Hundreds and hundreds, maybe a thousand people sitting behind desks. Reminded me of Brazil, the 1984.
Yeah. And then there's a scene where all these young women are chasing after Anthony Perkins. And it was almost like A Hard Day's Night. They're like running up the stairs like after him and then looking, you know, through these this picket fence type of arrangement and so forth.
And both Touch of Evil and The Trial feel like you're trapped in a nightmare world. Like they feel surreal and strange. Mm-hmm. I want to shout out, I mean, this one feels obvious, but I think even fewer people have seen it than Citizen Kane, which is his follow-up, The Magnificent Ambersons from 1942. Now, if you want to get into a complicated history of behind-the-scenes chicanery, this is maybe the most famous butchered movie
of all time. Let's face it, nobody has ever seen the original take
Test audiences at the time, and who knows if any of them are still alive. They're still looking for the lost footage of The Magnificent Ambersons. But even in its butchered form, it is such a beautiful, elegiac, and also satirical film about American life. I mean, it's set at the turn of the century, but, you know, post-Depression, World War II era audiences would have understood what he was trying to say about the American experience at the time. But one of my great like what ifs is, what if in my lifetime someone finds the original cut of The Magnificent Ambersons? It'll be one of the great days in
film. I think this could
film.
Be your vacation quest or something, you know? This could be your vision quest.
Even touched on his attempts at Shakespeare from Macbeth or Othello.
Falstaff in Chimes at Midnight.
Or, in non-Shakespeare, how about The Lady from Shanghai?
Yeah. Or his weird meta-documentary, F for Fake. If you haven't seen that, I remember
seeing that in the Irish Film Center in 1993. And I was like, wow, I'm glad I got to see this film because I hadn't previously.
Yeah, so lots of great viewing options for you. Dig into Welles' career.
And with that, that was our discussion of the work of Orson Welles and his greatest achievement, Citizen Kane, which, of course, is available to rent on all the major digital outlets. You've been listening to Movies 101. I'm Nathan Weinbender, along with Mary Pat Truthart and Dan Webster. Let's take this moment to thank Aaron Weir for directing the show. And we thank you, too, our loyal listeners, and we invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out the best cinema has to offer, even if it's not as good as Citizen Kane. Until then, consider these words from none other than Orson Welles. If you want a happy ending, that depends, of course, on where you stop your story. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.